model I want to use here is much more discussion-oriented than lecture. We're trying to work out an issue that I've been struggling with my entire life. I sort of found myself, the way I usually start this year, which I've now given off and on around in Los Angeles for 14 years, is that stuff he got when I was in college. My friend, then African act, now I'm in African again. I was Tzimtzum Aliyah, and I decided to divide up the world of Jewish thought, in which he got religious Zionism and I got everything else. because I really wasn't sure I was prepared to deal with religious Zionism, but I found myself 14 years ago at Harper's Hill feeling compelled that I had to say something in Yom HaZivut. And so I started giving what I call the Sikha on addressing what I think are the inescapable tensions in developing the knowledge of religious Zionism. And the reason I did it was because I discovered that in fact I was terribly committed as a religious Zionist, but that I was not capable of articulating well what that meant, and it wasn't clear to me that anybody else was doing a good job either. So there's just an ongoing working out of the issues I want to use there. And I want to define when I'm talking about first, but I tend to give a really beautiful description of what it means to be a lover of Zion, and a lover of Eretz Yisrael. And I considered putting that Ramban on the garlic. What I want to focus on really is on the religious relationship to the state of Israel, which is not Israel, as opposed to Eretz Israel. I want to take it as a given that people love Eretz Israel, that there's a value in living there, and we'll talk about why it should matter to us, if it does, that we have a state, right, a Jewish state in the land of Israel. And I'm going to start, to often do, by trying to make the hardest case of recent facts that seems to pose the greatest challenge to religious leaders' legitimization of Zionist endeavor, not the Shalosh Shavuot, the committee, right, the three O's, the committee we've had them already, but a bunch of other texts that are still actually live in our consciousness, that still have real cultural impact, even in the religious Zionist community, and ask you how you relate to them, what you need, let's say, when you take a liturgical text, what does it mean to you when you read it? And then from there we'll move into what I see as a series of responses to that, which are the attempts to explicitly articulate religious science philosophy and see how well they work and how well they don't. So we start with a Rashi. This is a Rashi in Gemara Sukkah, say, Dr. Nim Aleph and Aleph. It shows up in an entirely technical context. The question is, at what point can you start eating the grain of the new year? Halachically, you only begin eating the grain of the new year, at least in Eretz Yisrael. We'll talk about whether or not halachos chadash and chutzlaretz now or not, when the Korban Omer was brought. And the Ultimate Zaka, after the Bekanishim was destroyed and the Omer was no longer brought, the Ultimate Zaka made the decree that you could not eat the Omer at any point during the first day of Chol Moed Pesach. And the Gemara wants to know why he makes this decree, and the answer was because really, biblically, it should become permitted to eat the new grain the moment that the dawn of the first day of Chol Moed Pesach begins. And this is a trade that next year, the next Megillah will be rebuilt, and then you can't eat the Omer until the Korban Omer is brought, and people will say, well, last year we ate it at dawn, why can't we eat this year at dawn either just because the Beit Hamikdash was rebuilt? In the context of the Gemara's discussion, the Gemara turns out that the only real concern is that the Beit Hamikdash was built the night before. At which point the Gemara says, right, the Rashi says, V'ikash yudalala in a new time. You're going to say, hang on a sec, you can't build the Beit Hamikdash at night. You quote the whole series of Shulchan and Shulchan, you're not allowed to build the Beit Hamikdash at night, especially the night before the Yom Tov. And going to the Beit Hamikdash doesn't put this like Yom Tov. How can the Gemara say that Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai made this decree because of fear of the image was built the night before? The Gemara ends up thinking that Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai probably didn't make a decree at all, it was probably the right stuff, but I'm only interested in the Gemara context. So Rashi says, "Hani milayin binyana b'nuvi de'adam." Right? That only applies to the Beit Hamikdash which is built by human hands. But Midasha teach on something, but the future temple, the future sanctuary which we anticipate, when we just follow the Yigvah Yabom and Shemayim, it's when it becomes entirely complete from heaven. And he quotes the Pasuk in Hagia Shia, Midasha Shem Zimri Yadetha, right, the temple that God your hand filled that out. So that's one image. And one image is the Yigvah Yishmayim, and that image, while it relates only to the temple in Hagia Shemayim, seems to suggest that the redemption that we're anticipating is not supposed to be human at all. It's supposed to be, a deus ex machina, a temporal creation, where just descends from heaven. That's one text. And obviously that text seems to be in total contradiction to the whole notion of a dying standard, right? And what I'm going to show as we go through is that the issue is not so much whether one wants to take this as an absolute, which I think that, again, Finian decided that you're not going to take this as an absolute, but to what extent this kind of image, right, there's some element, there has to be something about the redemption of the supernatural, survive, and how that measures, how that affects our theology. The second text, the one I turn to you, is a text that is the standard text of the Mitzvah. And it says, in the same time, the end of the Leah Mea Sene, because of that, as a result of our sin, we are exiled from Homeland, then you're a fact in the Abba Sene, and resistance from upon our earth. And I think, they have to have believed all those that are associated with the basis of your assessment, et cetera, et cetera. So what does it mean? What does it mean when you say, because of our sin, we are exiled from Homeland? I don't understand, what's your experience, if you say it? What's your experience of saying it in the context of a world situation in which we are not, right? In which Jews are not exiled from the land, which is that, right? And which is not even hard to, right, to go there as a child. You don't have to tell these tremendous romantic tales of people struggling through battles with crusaders and getting on storm top ships and all that, or to buy a ticket. And so what does it mean? Okay, all right, so I think that's a very good presentation of the way in which we generally relate to this text, which is that we try and find some way in which Galut still applies. All right, so we're not out of Galut yet, because the image is not rebuilt. And that expresses, if you read this text, right, this text sort of conflates two issues. From the beginning it said, because our sins were exiled from our land, and it says, therefore we can't go to the temple, or we're in a betrayed state. Whereas if you have the land, you don't have the temple. That seems to be a intermediate condition that the text never considered. And that's an important tension to think about. Like, what is the value of the land? Right? What is the value of of removal from exile, which doesn't end up in the temple? Is it only valuable as a way station? Right? We say that, there's Galut and Gula, and we got a little bit closer to Gula, but we're still in Galut. Yes.
So we can use the next line.
Yeah.
Who says, bring that to the city of Judah, join the effort, and see if you have a faith. That's not about the majority. It's telling us to tell them, spark is a big thing with us.
Okay, they might argue that it's all part of this process. Mm-hmm. Right? Everything is stages on the process. Okay. That's an image I have to think about. Do we think, the same tension we have on Pesach, is whether we really need Dayanim. Right? If God had taken us out of Egypt and just left us a fundamental shrine in the desert and no walkover, that really didn't happen. Right? That seems to be contradicted by the notion of Zira, right? Where we're counting from Exodus to Sinai, because the whole purpose of Exodus was to get to Sinai. Right? Those are two very different visions. There are definitely points in Dayanim where I feel tall. Where it's just going, no. It doesn't matter. It wouldn't matter so much to me at all.
Then in Egypt,
what
they were free.
Right?
The then? They had a chance
to be kind of free. So it's better than being a slave,
Okay. Then when you halfway through the desert, okay, then they say, well, once we left Egypt, that's fine. But then right here, the difference here, the structure of Egypt is fascinating, but it's not. If you ask people instinctively what the structure of Egypt is, they'll tell you it's linear, but it's not. It starts from the Exodus, and then it gets read, and then it goes back and brings you up to the Exodus, and then it goes forward the rest of the time. It's actually very interesting. It's a very interesting poem that way. But in this text, to me, The challenge I want to set up is, do we feel that we have stopped the sin that caused us to be exiled from our land? So that's an interesting question, because if you were to claim we're still in Galus, then fine. But if we're still in Galus, then nothing happened. And on the other hand, if something has changed, if we were exiled from our land, then we're no longer exiled from our land. But the reason we're exiled from our land is our sin. Do we feel that we're better? Do we feel that we're better than any previous generation, such that we have merited coming back to the land, that the Galut is no longer an exar upon us? Right? That to me is a very deep challenge to a theology of religious Zionism. That's where I want to we'll take that on scripture.
I think there's even more of this is when you look at things like that Peter's injury, which is talking about as a great city, but then you know, looking at your life, you do that and such,
So there's two kinds of tensions, right? The one kind of tension is, my wife thought that was often, is the notion of ingratitude. Right? When you say not right, can you say not pain? I thought it was destroyed through your lines actually rebuilt. And that's important, right? That's an important point. I want to focus in this session not so much on that issue, but on the question of how we deal with an implicit claim of spiritual superiority. If we in fact acknowledge, if only you keep saying nothing, you realize you mean it for real, and you say, you know what we had so far is meaningless, right? We're really still in Galut, absolutely, we have to return to it, right? That's fine. But then you're not really much really a right. But if you take what has happened as significant, then you have to deal with, so how does that relate to the theory of history, right? So on top of it, you have to have a theory of history. If they have to do it, go to them here and which would seem to imply that they believe in Tehu. Shall we learn them? Right, that's it.
Put in the history, the center of happened, it happened after the Holocaust, and then it was supposed to be after that, but then they, you know, the only how it happened, no one would say, oh, it was because the Jews were so wonderful, and that's it, too, and, you know,
that's... So I agree with you.
You could have healed without that.
Almost nobody, in fact, makes the claim that we have merited it in a way because we are better than our ancestors. And in fact, it's an almost absurd claim, with the possible exception of Rav Kook, who makes all sorts of claims that are really interesting.
If you look at the
Holocaust,
you know, the
Jews
were
really
the interpreted as having a positive presence.
You can make that claim. I think it's a strong claim to make that we satisfied our mission in the diaspora. We're first trying to make that claim in that Zionist claim. We haven't satisfied our mission in the diaspora. And that's why, right? And that's why you're not a Zionist. Yes, you know, I'm open to it. I think it's a strong claim. Yes.
I guess I'm wondering about the more, to me, which is more sort of almost basic tension between the idea of being exiled originally for sort of for sin,
mm-hmm.
with the way we see the world today, where typically Peter's gone on sort of talking in those terms about, you know, a people or a group suffering because of their sins, you normally sort of say that's total outlandish, right? And you have the people who turned out in the tsunami and also the other because they were sinful or, you know, Billy Graham kind of stuff about, you know, so if you weren't gay, you shouldn't have gotten into the first place, you know, that sort of thing. So today, you don't normally talk in terms of
absolutely
people suffering for their sins, right? So there's a significant tension between that, but actually the modern sense of how the world works, and the sort of premise.
Terrific. Good. Well, that's the theme that really goes through all the way through. Okay, so now I want to try and read some text with you. Another question,
I wonder if we can look at these as good things for me,
So it's only those of the Arcanians we were removed from our spiritual centers, and we still are. So I think that, you know, so you can make it spiritual as opposed to physical. If I had done that Ramban, I would have pointed out that Ramban knows that Eretz Yisrael actually gets very complicated. It's not clear that the Eretz Yisrael always means the physical land of Israel when he says those things about those. But again, if you say that, so the problem is you devalue the Zionist achievement. Right? As my wife said, it's a paradox. Right? You can devalue the Zionist achievement and say, well, this doesn't relate to what happens spiritually. But that, and that solves the problem of how are we claiming to be virtuous, but it means why we care. And on the other hand, once you give value to it religiously, right, once you put the Zionism on the Galut Geula axis, then you have to address the why we deserve it. Right? And if you want to take the way out and claim that we don't think deserving is relevant, so then you end up, and that's why you end up claiming the history of meaning. Because history says it's unrelated to virtue. If history is unrelated to vice and virtue, my Jewish history is unrelated to vice and virtue, then it's just happened. Right? And we'll see. But we'll get the Yishai Leibowitz is going to make essentially that claim right at the end, toward the end of this year. So I want to first, the best presentation of the problem that I was having, because I know, is in a, fan complex novel that shows him, which I read, I guess, at some point in high school, and then when I first started talking about this, I've got to find that quote, because it says, so brought home to me. So the context is that, the Chassidish Rebbe, who is a complicated figure in the story, gets up and gives a drasha on Shabbos in words, where this is happening in the late 40s. And he gives a drasha which is built around the story of a pagan Chassid who spends his life dreaming of Eretz Yisrael. Basically, he tells Rav Nachman. He tells Rav Nachman, or the Yehuda Levi story, and the last thing he does is he gets to the grave, he gets to Eretz Yisrael, he gets to the Kotel, and he dies. And that's the end of the story. And the Von Ernst Nachman raises his hand and comments, and says, you know, some people now may think Eretz Yisrael is a place for Jews to live, and not just to die. To which the Rebbe explodes and he says, who are these people? Who are these people? And he curses Goyim, and Goyim is Goyim, will build their control. They'll build throughout the Jewish land, they'll bring forest to land. Goyish types will bring into land, not Syria. God will build the land, not in Goyim and Goyim. And the Shia comes, then will enter Israel, not a land contaminated by Jewish Goyim. He's got the Rashi in there, the God will build the land. He's got the Ramban in there, the land right that you can say, sins contaminated the land. The land in Avon Yitzchak and Yaakov should be built by Jewish land, but contaminated men. Never, not what it is, who says these things. Who says we should now build Eretz Yisrael? And where is the Mashiach? Tell me we should forget completely about the Mashiach. Is this the color of people with voters that we should forget completely about the Mashiach? That we should forget completely about the master of the universe, the governor of our soul. But the thesis he's setting out, as I understand it, is to claim that you can have a return from Galut in a time of mass non-observance is to devalue 1,000 years of Jewish history. For 1,000 years of history, people believe that 1,000 years of Jewish history, right? For 1,000 years, people doubted and they thought it meant. They think about men and believe in our thing. No, the only way to get back is if we, we get better. And now you have a generation which is worse in all possible ways. They're not Shomer Shabbos. They're not Shomer Kashrus. They don't do any of these things. And they get out of control. And we celebrate this. So he argues, right, that in order to, right, to be a religious Zionist, his point is to essentially, right, engage with Shlomo HaGalut, right, Shlomo HaGalut in the strongest sense, which is to claim that, you know what, for 1,000 years you guys have been praying, that was the wrong thing. So it didn't matter. And if it didn't choose them, and that didn't matter. The only thing that mattered was politics. And you can deal with it as you should, and it's not connected to anything religious. And that's the right that I wanted. What he asserts, essentially, that way, is that to allow political Zionism is to make history in England. It's to claim that history does not need to reflect whether God loves you or not. And that's a central theological challenge, right? Is can you have religious Zionism that A, does not engage what we call halakhically Masilah and al-Rishonim to defame all right, defame the past generations because it's called Rachel Nikon basically dashed him up. He was for a right, as opposed to because he didn't keep Shabbat, that's why the Mishnah wasn't built, because he didn't build certain things. Right, we bad pictures of, right, any generation that hasn't built what they've been is destroyed. And we usually think that means because they didn't keep Shabbat, they didn't keep Joshua, we said much in Hara, it's only terrible thing, but no, it's because we didn't build it. That's all.
But if you don't have it, there's nothing else there.
Why?
Well, they might have the opportunity to build it.
That's right, but they spent their time praying. They could have been draining swamps and engaging in negotiations with the Ottoman Empire. Right? And you don't think it's possible? You don't think it's possible?
Well,
I don't know.
Do you really need to know?
People try. Some people try. And
they do that.
Okay. Now here's a... I'm interested in the question of whether you can find a way to give religious meaning to Zionism without detaching history from the virtue-based axis. And whether that matters, if you don't care religiously, right? One of the top solutions, yes. Okay, I'm not going to address that directly because I'm really focused on the theology and not right, and not the. I think that you can. You know, the position they're taking essentially, the interesting intellectual position as opposed to all the difficult ethical issues with the way you live, is that living in Israel is still a value, but living in Israel under foreign domination is still godless. And what they acknowledge essentially is that political independence is part of your law, and they don't want it. And it's interesting that it requires taking some way to some of these positions that depend on the Israel situation of the devil. Which, that really isn't a position. It really, it's a startling position. It gives more power to the devil than any other theology in history. it's almost become like a Zoroastrian vision. Very strange vision. Brilliant, very strange. Okay. Now I want to read a Rambam as setting up a slightly different context for this, but which is also, in a sense, responding to some of the issues raised by Papa's character. It's not a Hilchot Melachim, as Hector did here, says, Al Yaleh Alei Shrimot HaMashiach Yivatel Devar, or Yivatel Devar Min HaGosh HaOlam, or yet Sham Chidush HaMaseh Breshit, El Olam Min HaGonaveh. Don't believe that in messianic times the laws of nature change the place. Nothing's gonna change. Alam Sina Gona Vek. The Zesh Chin Amar Bishaya the Garza Haven Kevis and American Gidir Bat, Mashal Bakida. And so Ishaya says that the wolf will live, but the sheep, all those are metaphors. Okay, and he goes on, right? Yeah, the Lord is for meeting. Shayu Israel, Yashvin, Lebeta, in the Shayakim, and Shulim, because I'm here. It means that the wicked non-Jews will leave us alone. Right? We will live in, right? We will live in security. But then he adds, yeah, through Kulam Adat Emet, and everybody will worship the true religion, and there will be no sex, and there will be no destruction. And he goes on and tells you everything else about the name of Mashiach is also addressed in that word. And then Akilah, on the sages said, and that Alam has deadly most from Mashiach, Ela Shebud Malkiyot Zobah. There is no difference between this world and the days of the Messiah, other than subordination to government. Shebud Malkiyot. And in that time, there will be no famine or war or jealousy or envy, as it goes to be widespread. Now, if you say, it should be clear to you that the Rambam is hopelessly contradictory. Right? That to claim on the one hand the only difference between this world and that world is some political independence, and at the same time, right, and we'll be living together with the wicked Gentiles, who, by the way, will all return to the true, right, to the true religion, and have, right, and have, right, and we know that, but we know that after destruction, and by the way, we know famine, right, the world is not as it is, but we know famine, and no war, right, so this is, right, this is a fascinating passage in the Rambam, right, which I think that the utter incoherence of it, has given insufficient notice. And the question we always have when Rama contradicts himself is we tend to assume he contradicts himself deliberately. Right? Famously in the introduction to the guy, he says there are seven reasons to contradict children. One of them is you don't want people to really know what you're thinking. And I have the move by trying to get those athletes to become much more stealthy than just to just take you back to even really more seriously than I used to. What I want to set out Rama is trying to bridge and that's the easiest way to frame it. He's trying to set out a very naturalistic notion of the Messianic era, and yet no one will recognize it. And what's the point of the Messianic era world when we have this political independence? And it's not clear where he ends up. It's not clear what he's expressing. You can frame it as he has this really naturalistic vision, but he's ending his book and this is not, you know, it's not going to sell. You say that, you know, at the end of it is we're going to have a state which will give us political independence, and our state, you know, it'll have Jewish prophets and Jewish thieves and Jewish things like that, and yay! Right? Because that, you know, that's not going to work for the SSO and the nice stuff. Or it could be that he has a naturalistic vision, but for himself, you know, he's reading Isaiah. And they're all Mishalim, they have to be Mishalim for something. Right? The guy's aging chariots, okay, it's an allegory. It doesn't mean that lions will lie down, right? That wolves will lie down with sheep, but it has to be something. Right? That's something, right? So now that, those two elements both need to be accounted for. So on the one hand, if you want to emphasize the change in human nature, that seems to be essential to any supernatural vision of the Messianic era, then the problem is we don't seem to see that. And then the thing that we have is not the Messianic era at all. Last I heard, we were not living in peace with the wolves of Ukraine, with the wolves around us. On the other hand, if you just take the naturalistic element of the realm and you say that the only difference between the Yod and Mashiach and the Lama Zed is she did not feel, well, guess what? Mashiach came. Now we can start playing. Mashiach hasn't come all the way because we're still subject to the whims of the United States government. Mm-hmm. Right? But it's still famous, but you know, again, it's a lucky of Shigur Mafia, something of me, to some degree, right, the political economy. You have this tension, right, the second tension, which is that in order to make the state meaningful, you have to either diminish the impact of that, right, if it has diminished the impact of Messianism, then you have to wonder, so what's left? Right, why are we still looking for it? Why are we still looking for Mashiach, in such a sense? So I want to take you through, this is the quote here, I want to take you through a bunch of responses. Tradition magazine, in 1968, and again, I believe, in 1992, ran a symposia on religious Zionism. Now, they ran these symposia in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, and what's really interesting is that the kind of issues that are expressed here really came out after 1967, not after 1948. And the questions that they asked, essentially, were, do you believe, I'm the apparatus, do you believe that the course of Israeli history is meaningful in a way that we can interpret. And I do believe that what happened in Israel between 1948 and 1967 is, right, displays a pattern of God acting in history which we can't interpret religiously. And that was a challenge. That was a challenge they put forth. The specific question the Winston Girl of Shalom, in his introduction, impatience of the religious community's reluctance to grapple with these issues has grown immeasurably as a result of the Six-Day War. Many maintain that the spectacular victory, culminating with the recapture of spiritual life, represents an extraordinary manifestation of divine purpose in history. They are convinced that the events leading to the Holocaust of present-day Israel reveal a unique and special way that God acts in history. Others disagree. They cannot, they argue, presume that any of God's purposes nor are we equipped to apprehend a special divine intervention. As human, rationally human beings, we must interpret historical events in purely naturalistic categories. Historic phenomena must therefore be explained exclusively in light of political and military realities. They're asking directly, do we think that history has to be direct and meaningful, that we have to ask ourselves the question, what does it mean that this happened? Is that a religious question to ask? Because we just say, no, the world happens, and we just, right, and we deal with the results. Not with, right? Yeah, okay, now we have political dependence in Israel. What does that mean for us religiously? As opposed to, yeah, right, God gave us political dependence in Israel, that must mean. Okay, here's a series of responses. The first one is from Professor Michael Wishenrod. Some of you studied this. He's a really interesting insight. I think it's fair to say probably the only contemporary Jewish biblical philosopher. The only Orthodox philosopher who writes philosophy based on Tanakh and other Rabbinic literature. Really fascinating. Really, really fascinating thinker. His classic work is called The Body of Faith. And he also has a collection of essays called The Talmud of Abraham, I think. Which, if you're interested, you can also see my review of the tradition. Really, really fascinating, valuable reading. It's not always convincing. Only Orthodox philosopher who does philosophy based on Tanakh. He just comes straight from Tanakh. And right here, but even with Orthodox rabbinic literature, right, you know, it is a bit, right, you know, there's no unmediated approach to Tanakh on the whole. Right, but those who are just, it's not, but it's true. You know, you can read through his book, and if you know some rabbinic stuff, it's useful. But most of these just things, and yet it's fully Orthodox. It's a stunning thing. And really, you know, it's not just a radical notion for among other things, you know, what we call the body of faith, because it's an attack on Rama. Right, the whole notion of that is incorporealism. That is, you know, he launches a very direct attack, and he thinks that the Rama's denial of the personhood to God is one of, you know, the terrible turn in Jewish philosophy, and we should undo it as rapidly as possible. Really, it's a fascinating critique. Okay, so here's what it says. The history of the entire world is in God's hand. Where does he move the world? This is one of the great mysteries. We find ourselves in a relatively clearer position, however, when dealing with Jewish history. Here we encounter a peculiar process which operates on unique principles set forth by the early Hebrew prophets and fortified by the teachings of the rabbis. Moving along against this setting, our task is not to probe whether we can see God's hand in the events which take place and then search the theological interpretation of these events. Our method in this case is rather the reverse. We have to see how and to what extent do these events fit into God's divine church history as outlined and described in such remarkable detail in the Torah and in the utterances of the prophets and the sages. It is not God's intervention that we should take pains to see, rather examine our part in the events which we witness. So he says it also deals with the issue of supernatural versus natural. We have to look for things miraculous or not. The only question is, we know that Jewish history is meaningful. All Jewish history is meaningful. Here we have categories describing Jewish history. Galut and Yula. Korban and Binyan. So we don't need to address the question of the Six-Day War was a miracle. We just need to address the question of where on the arc of Jewish history as described in Tanakh does having Yerushalayim fit? And the answer to that question is straightforwardly. Is the second to last paragraph. is during the last 100 years they've had him telling us during the time of the rainbow was over that Israel is established and the land is being cultivated, the land is being cultivated, there are all signs of the case. Now the 60 wars are spread to Syria more forcefully, but actually the first Jews settled Israel and Syria did not to us. He built the same miracle, the same revelation of the hand of God as the Israeli earthquake which has destroyed the Egyptian plains. It's all part of one story, one saga, the beginning of the reestablishment of Israel and the return of the exiles out of their free will of being forced to do so. It is the belief of many Gedolim. It's an interesting statement to Gedolim from our philosopher. It shows up in a bunch of other articles. That the return of Jews to Eretz Israel will hasten the arrival of the Messiah. Everything in Jewish history so far points to this, and we are witnessing its fulfillment. We are already in a very advanced stage of the Messianic era, not just on the verge of it. Our casting doubt on this is tantamount to questioning the validity of Torah and prophecy, and is a serious flaw in our faith. But that's a pretty straightforward thing. And we don't have to deal, it doesn't deal with the question of virtue versus vice, because the issue is that there are markers in Jewish history, and basically Mashiach came. And I'm giving you right, you know, from the philosopher, I'm not going to cook in here.
So how would you deal?
Oh, we'll get there, don't worry. We'll get there. I'm going to give you a 1992 answer also.
Well,
the principle of Mashiach is not here yet, but on the whole, right, on the whole, we were in a very advanced stage of the Messianic era, right? We were called Nisus of the Gula. We did not meet Israel, M-T-I-T-S-I-K-A-G-U-R, something like that,
whether in, I guess, the writing view or in this block, or maybe what's not, completely disconnected from the notion of the temple being destroyed in the very season and needing to prepare that to get back to the
original. Well, let's finish the dialogue, okay? It's all covered, okay? So now the second respondent that I'm getting here is Rosh Aryashu's comment, who is currently the Chidash Nazir Rabbi of Haifa. At that point, he was at the Mayor of Lion. He's the son of the Nazir. It's all a very interesting, wonderful human being. And he writes the following. There is no doubt in my mind that we're living now in the Yemot Mashiach. I have no explanation for the Holocaust. I have no explanation for the miracles of the War of Independence. I have no other explanation for the miracle of the Six-Day War, but the belief that we are part of the final Gula. Those from Kuf Vatsal and first Kuf Vatsal have the same idea. It is tragic that the present leadership of the rabbit in Israel and outside of Israel is afraid to rise to the moment by creating new means and methods. Because being in the Messianic era requires altering halakha in all sorts of interesting ways, and Tony is still advocating that we issue a decree that we're allowed to go in Har HaBayit in order to solve that issue. All sorts of interesting claims he's made. Our minds should be geared to making Israel the central abode of the Jewish people, to making them a method to unite the Goy Kadosh. It's not a theological question anymore. It's admitting that what we see and hear is the hand of God acting in history. I am sure that the Six-Day War has started a new era of understanding between religions. The Jew will not be an angola that this, among others, has to clarify the dividing principle between Jews and Gentiles. It is now becoming an orla goyim. This, I think, is the deep meaning of the happening of the Six-Day War from a religious point of view. So Rabbi Wurzberger asks, but where are the universalistic implications that are associated with the Messianic era? After all, Isaiah did not speak of the Messianic era merely in terms of the restoration of the Jewish people, and why Rambam has to say this, but also speaks of the era of universal peace and justice, except against the Christian Mekedah, which is, we could talk about Yeshaya at that time, right? You know, live together, you have to tell those who are trying to do not live together in their Bodhat Mekedah, so Yeshaya is not the universal peace, actually. Okay. Sarah Cohen says, that's why I mentioned interfaith relationships, which, by the way, he's still very, very involved in. He's involved in the Alexandria program and the relationship with the Vatican, right? He's a representative to all these interreligious conferences. I believe that the Tziat HaGuf, the political and economic revival state of Israel, is only the beginning. A starting point. Miracles and the sphere of religious experience in the state of Israel will follow. Then we'll see the real Mashiach. So the Wurzberger, obviously being the sober man, and this room at this point says, the Vietnam War, the Cold War, race riots here who claim ourselves in the Messianic Age? And of course, seriously, I feel these are additional reasons why we're doing this. Because everything, right? Because there are great things, there are terrible things, and everything is the Mashiach. And he didn't say why. I don't know. And I didn't ask him about this when we met. But here you have. I want to state that Christian Wittergott and Rebbe Cohen, they are the typical religious Zionist responses. Right, that's what pretty much all religious Zionists think. From what I can tell, I don't know why, just more than 96 days. But that's what everyone thinks, right? The hand of God has been revealed in history. This is, right, you can, that's when you start saying things like Rashid Nihat Ulatayim, right? And wondering whether Rashid is to come.
Is there a distinction between witchcraft and cult? Because, and I make one up about this difference of reality. The events of witchcraft recall just came about not from any sort of belief on the part of Churchill or Heinrich that they were religious imperatives to do what they did. It just happened that they saw political events and they thought this was a logical way to proceed and suddenly for the Six-Day War. It wasn't that the Israel thought, oh, the Messiah was here, it is time for us to go conquer these lands. It was just the reality was that the war was sent. And that's how it came about. So there was, and so then he would say, well, this is consistent with God's plan. But it seems to be Cohen might be more proactive than saying, oh, now we know we're in the days of the camp, but now we can do things like we know we're supposed to have this way. And we know we're supposed to go to our bias and maybe.
Absolutely. But I think what you are also believing is that the recognition that you're in a spirit of the world imposes imperatives. Right? It's not just... Because we claim that, oh, wasn't he doing a Mashiach and then had no Nafkaminas? Right? That you don't behave any differently because you're living in Mashiach. That's an almost impossible claim to sustain. If you can make the claim intellectually, to some extent, a lot makes that claim now. Mm-hmm. Right? And a lot of the tension is that it's really impossible to sustain. When you think that you're living in the Messianic era, you always get driven to say, and therefore, we're so close. Right? We can take chances we shouldn't otherwise. Things like that. Lord Jacobus has an interesting article which I didn't see sitting here. It's a beautiful piece about how belief, there are real concrete consequences to believing you live in the Messianic era, and they're ineluctable. Right? You can't, you know, there's all sorts of, it's the same way people try and maintain the position that Kabbalah is distinct from Halakha, and you can live in a bifurcated world if you think that the rationale should be sort of Kabbalistic, but you interpret Halakha and Harrow mechanically, but take a test and the mother says, you can't sustain it. Eventually, the Kabbalistic reasons lead over into the law. And so you can't claim that the Messiah, where it's middle of the Messianic era, and along with another one of the Hagen, we behave aggressively, it's not sustainable in the long run. Yes?
Well, you mentioned Rashid, you have a Kabbalistic.
Yes.
David Chesnut, given the fact that
how
about
him with
the
hedge,
either
it's Rashid, either it's Rashid, right? We compromised. Yeah. Oh, we compromised, right? And then Moshe came up with the additional compromise of Chesnut. Hey, Rashid, me, five, four, ten, right? All these, right? Yeah, because not everybody won, right? You know, there was a balance. Okay, I want to read the last response, which I think still Russell was close. I was asking Robert Mann, currently transferred to the university. He was really, and you can tell that Ritzberger was the background, is raising the question from Atlanta, was the only one who came, right, who directly said in that symposium, no. You can't make claims like that. He said the following. Right? He said, we are, I think, going very far astray if our two participants in Israel declared so positively, and to me was shocking dogmatism, that we are presently in the midst of the Messianic Mashiach. I must say I feel astounded. For if you accept this as a Messianic era, you have to draw certain consequences. You have to be aware that unconsciously you're adopting the reform interpretation of the Messianic era in which Mashiach is no longer an individual personality. Speaking of an era instead of the personality of Mashiach, that's more of 19th century progressivism than it does in the reasonable Jewish concept. I'd like to remind you that Mashiach, according to the interpretation of Chazal, will only come as a Hadad. The more we talk about him, the less likely he's going to come. We can try to understand, but it happens in terms of Hester Panim and Siyat Panim because they have religious consequences. So he's not claiming that there's no religious meaning. He just wants the word religious meaning for nothingness. Right? And to say, Ralam, committed early Zionist who spent at least 48 hold up somewhere in the capital of the manufacturing empire. for the academic review, the chance to review studies of chemistry students, but can't question his credentials on it. Okay? It means that our people have seen something, and therefore the burden falls upon us as Orthodox community to do something. Whereas if the events are part of the Messianic era, the attitude of the and Fetus says, I mean, build an army, let's forget the Mashiach. The point is that we are now in a stage where an entire people has once again seen the strange skin of the Galilee here in America. Thus, in a certain opportunity, we must throw certain consequences, whereas if you speak only in Messianic terms, I'm afraid it's going to get further, as it always has been. Okay, so it's interesting here. He's not really responding to the right calling, so Michelle and says, Mashiach, because it's going to come, we have to do something, or do I have the phrase, Mashiach, over here, why do we have to do anything? So, he's not really responding to what Rabbi Cohen's saying, but he is saying really, really sharply that I don't think we should say Mashiach is here, because all things have happened. Okay, now I'm going to tell an elementary graphical story, which, for me, was a really, really important moment in who I am as a religious writer. At one point, there's an organization called Mizrahi, probably many of you remember it, may still exist, Religious Zionists in America, which was a dominant influence in American Orthodoxy. The Rome gives dramatic keynote addresses every year, which have been collected. It was a dominant thing. By, I believe it's just about 1991 or 92, it is a more of an organization. I was there, but that's how I spent it. But basically, you go to the annual Mizrahi convention, they're all not getting the keynote anymore, and the average age is 70. The average age is 70. So, a group of powerful Mizrahi leaders of the previous generation came to OYU, and they asked to meet with a group of young Sliha leaders to ask us to take over the organization. Because they need young boys. And here's my perspective of what happened in the conversation. The people involved there's people I have tremendous respect for, many of them are my teachers. But the conversation largely failed. And here's my sense of why the conversation failed. They got up and they said, 1967, miracles, hand of God in history, hand to God inspire everybody. And some of us looked at them and said, our experience of war was, we remember 73, which was a blitz for them, and the real experience was the people our age going to Lebanon and not winning, got not intervening on their side, right? Got seemed entirely neutral because the outcome was entirely neutral. And we weren't even sure we were right. My own sense was that our Sharon had deceased Prime Minister Begin, Prime Minister Begin's one of my great heroes, and I never forgive Sharon for doing that. And so we had a totally different vision of religious violence that had to be, and nothing happened, we were incapable of communicating across, as they were talking to ladies, which is why they come and we're talking in this symposium, and that was, for most of us, at that point, not a meaningful category. It didn't work at all. Now, the interesting thing to me is that the generations have shifted again, and actually there's another generation from that language does work again now. And we can talk about why that is, but at that point it didn't work for me at all. And some sense of how that happened is if you take a look, in 1992, tradition ran the same symposium. And that symposium, everyone, right, different people, but the way that our United shifted entirely the other way. Basically, no one was willing to make the Messianic claims anymore. No one was willing to make the Hand of God history claims, with one exception, such as David Berger, who's currently the Dean of Yeshiva College, and he did tremendously powerful piece. Again, I still lose courage. Larry Lamb gets all the credit for me for the 1968 symposium, and Professor Berger gets all the credit in the 1992 one for saying the hard things. But first, I want to read Dr. Wishergood's 1992 response. Here's what he said in 1992. I do not preach absolute nonviolence in all circumstances, but I preach a high degree of nonviolence, a hatred of violence, a love of the land combined with a high degree of nonviolence, a largely nonviolent violence. A messianic Judaism that keeps alive the living expectation of the Messiah, but also the messianic repudiation of violence. A love of all human beings, whether Jewish or non-Jewish, a willingness to wait even temporarily yield territory, if that will save us from bloodshed. We may be on the verge of the Messianic era, but whether we are, right now, remember, the 68, we were in the advanced stage of the Messianic era. Now we may be on the verge of the righteous, the hate receives the cosmic opinion. We may be on the verge of the Messianic era, but I simply cannot believe that the Messianic era was preceded by the reality of Jews becoming accustomed to killing. I find it much easier to believe the Messianic era was preceded by the reality of Jews recognizing the image of God in all human beings, even those foolishly convinced that God did not promise the land to his people. That's a big shift. I quoted my favorite Rashi of these, I guess you may have said the other Rashi, said when Yaakov was praised, into this coming, but Yirah Yaakov knows the Yitzhavah, but Yirah, Shani Yarub, Shani Hareg, the Yitzhavah, Yarub, Yarub, who is Achim, Yaakov's word. So he, both perhaps equally about killing and being killed. So that's why Professor Richard is, still clinging to that threat, still clinging to that theism, but a very, very attenuated that theism. So we might say, okay, so we just turn it around, right? So, we tried the history in a meaningful approach. The history of a meaningful approach doesn't seem to have been true, like we said there. Because we stagnated, because in our interface understanding didn't happen. Right in the aftermath of Vatican II also, right? People are really excited, but now all of a sudden relations with Christianity seem to matter less than relationship with Islam, and a new era of interfaith understanding doesn't seem to have happened, in which, God's intervention in history seems to have, if you view the miraculous intervention on the side of the Jews as God's intervention in history, so that seems to have stopped. We don't have miraculous interventions on the side of the Jews anymore. And all, the world doesn't seem so different. These are the ones you're going to make. So against that, Professor Berger writes the following. Although God's knowledge is unlimited, and the possibility of intervention is always present, many major authorities have maintained that miraculous intervention in the daily lives of ordinary Jews is relatively infrequent. And some degree of uncertainty extends to larger matters as well. I am inclined to believe, for example, that God has something to do with the low casualty rate following the launching of Fred Nichols toward Israel. I do not feel that my faith requires a categorical affirmation that he changed the flight path of a particular missile, or causes worries to malfunction. Nonetheless, there are events so earth-shaking within the context of Jewish belief that the failure to attribute them to divine intervention leaves Judaism bereft of meaningful faith in the God of Shabbat and of the prophets. The establishment of the state of Israel and the capture of Jerusalem are such events. Given the most fundamental assumptions about providence, the goodness of God, and his concern for the Jewish people, the position of development of such magnitude came about only through the working of an impersonal historical process is inadmissible. It banishes God from history and declares the effect of the word has forsaken the earth. If the hand of God is not to be found in these events, where is it to be found? Recognition of the establishment of Israel as an act of God and doubly impacts the religious repercussions, it means that the refusal to celebrate them on split Yom Yerushalayim is the refusal to give thanks to God, it means that support Israel is a religious imperative, and the obligation of Aliyah demands for your attention. Okay, I found that a tremendously powerful statement. And that's where I thought the subtitle, the necessity and possibility of religious Zionism comes from. President Berger explains why religious Zionism is necessary. Because I think he has a really good point. If this isn't meaningful history, then nothing is. And if you think that history can't be meaningful, so then where, what is the meaning of biblical Judaism? On the other hand, the problem is that the meaning of it on the historical axis, as Professor Richard got said in 1967, doesn't correlate at all with the meaning of it on the religious axis in terms of virtue and vice. So we can't, it's not possible to connect it. You have to find some way of bridging between, on one hand, asserting that the event has meaning, and on the other hand, finding a way for the event to have meaning without thereby claiming that compels us to believe that we are more virtuous. Yes?
Well, you can also widen the lens and say that what happened here in 67 was the revival of Soviet Jewry, which led to the breakdown of the Soviet bloc, which led to the you know, all the changes in Europe, which led to, you know, the Catholic Mass Valley, even for the next valley after Israel, which led to, who knows what will happen.
So it was a new controversy in the creation of a large massive mountain of
If we look at it thematically, we don't know enough about how history plays out to know if what happened will still have an effect that we haven't seen yet.
We can't. I don't know either. I just think that the kind of rash claims that we're in '68 are no longer sustainable. But the other hand, the claim that you call now statistically, you know, it just looks like a lift. There's no meaning, but it's also very hard. So what I want to say is that what you notice, even in Dr. Berger's response, that he doesn't say anything about that here. He doesn't say anything about that. So what I want to go for is move here to say that I think that the messiness of religious Zionism has largely turned out to be that. The crisis in Israel was much, you know, because messiness Zionism really couldn't deal with restoration of God's moderation in terms of territorial things. Messiness Zionism is, I tend to think, not really a viable ideology anymore. But religious Zionism has to. We have to confront the problem that at least a significant percentage of religious Zionism was built on that kind of 68 euphoria, and that euphoria has dissipated and is not likely to be recaptured. And the question then is, in their capacity to build a theology of religious Zionism which is non-messianist, but nonetheless gives meaning to history in some way. So I want to start by going back to an essay of Rafael Eshet that happened well before 67. What's interesting is all the Rav's Zionist statements are pre-67. Really, we have very little one, just as I understand it, what the Rav is like as a Zionist in the aftermath of the 6-day war. The five addresses, all, you know, at least the published stuff is really much earlier. And this kind of rhetoric really, although now we look back and say, well, 48 is much, but somehow in 48 people still felt the tentativeness of it. They didn't have the confidence. And in 67, all of a sudden, it felt like this, you know, we're secure. And 73 shook that a little bit, but not so much, and then Lebanon really is where, right, Israeli that was dramatically shaken, and Oslo was just a shock. And in Gaza, you know, it's still going on, you know, and it's really a big issue. So this is the Rabbi in 1956, in Frederick Kaplan's translation. 8 years ago, in the midst of a night of terror filled with the horrors of Majdanek, Treblinka and Buchenwald, a night of gas chambers and crematoria, a night of absolute divine self-concealment, and a night ruled by the Satan of doubt and apostasy, which sought to sweep the maiden from her house into the Christian church, and a night of continuous searching and questing for the beloved. In that very night, the beloved appeared, right? We're in sharing, of course. God had concealed himself in his dazzling hiddenness, suddenly manifested himself and began to knock at the tent of his despondent and disconsolate love, existing convulsively in her bed, suffering the pains of hell. As a result of the knock from the door of the maiden, wrapped in mourning, the state of Israel was born. And Rav says there were six knots. You can go through them and see whether you think those are exactly the six knots he was talking about. But he has his six. And again, this is all rhetoric, which is, you know, you can't take it as literal seriousness. But he has his six knots. He's already been knocking for more than 8 years and hasn't received a proper response. Nevertheless, he continues to knock. We have been fortunate because in Shira Shirin, the beloved knocks on the door and then the time he wakes up disappears. But he continues to treat us with extreme patience. Okay, that's stage one. Now, God in itself is an interesting challenge. I often tell when I was in Israel, somewhere in the 90s, my friend Rabin Kutzlau, who was a different young athlete, my friend Rabin Kutzlau gave a tikhah to his students at the hotel, Phil Kutzlau, and the end of the tikhah was, and he's still knocking. And I said, how do you know? You don't know, right? You know, you can't have that kind of confidence. You know, always the risk that we wake up too late and we open the door and God's not there anymore. And we have to consider the possibility. You know, we don't like thinking about it, but it's happened. Then Rav says the following. We admire the state of all of our heart. We pray for her welfare. We center our sons and stand united in the center. But it is not the highest good. The highest ideal is our faith. The basic foundation of our existence is that beyond the river, which symbolizes the people in confrontation with God and with the new sort of life. They're not always happy with certain actions and tactics of the government, but that does not detract from the importance of the state of Israel as the instrument for the realization of possessing the land. We know the government itself is not the state. Governments come and governments go, but the land and the state, we hope, remain forever and ever. That is an interestingly complicated state. He specifically denies direct religious meaning to the state. Right? The state is the instrument of Jewish Eretz Yisrael. And that's it, right? And that's one mode, right? One mode of non-Messianic religious Zionism is to treat it, you know, as a really sober halakhic perspective, which is to say that the music, right, that the state enables us to perform the mitzvot of Yishuv Haaretz, and the mitzvot of Yishuv Haaretz enables us to perform the mitzvot of Tliyos Haaretz, so we come out ahead. Right? Or you can be more mystical and not be halakhic, and you can claim with the Ramban that the state enables us to live in Eretz Yisrael, and mitzvot are much more meaningful in Eretz Yisrael generally. But it's a religious Zionism which does not see political independence directly as a value.
What does he mean here in the previous paragraph
that the
foundation of
that religion? What is that, right? So it means that we, as Narasana mentioned earlier, we don't come from Eretz Yisrael. Right? So our religion is grounded in being the Greek, to the other side of the river, and it's what we bring to Eretz Yisrael that makes us Jews, not being Eretz Yisrael. Okay, and Eshner Mitzvendor was referencing that when he said it. So this is an interesting model to begin it here towards developing a non-Messianic religious Zionism, right, because if you identify, because the Shia is a political phenomenon. Right, even the Rambam of the Shia is more exposed to the political phenomena. What he does is he divorces Zionism from politics. Right? Politics are just a means to an end. And the end is religion. And he doesn't confront the question of what happens if we start looking at the state and we say the state is... Right? Now, they're good about saying that one should be careful not to evaluate the state in light of the particular government. That's very important because often it's a state of immaturity when you decide that you evaluate the existence of a state by the policies of a particular government, right? Because Shulamit Aloni, right, is the director of education, all of a sudden we're an anti-Semitic state, right, and then the next election, and a really strong person is a very old-minded Shah, right, the Shah school, is education minister, old red, you know, red year of the NRP and the education ministry, right, the Shulamit Aloni become the education minister of a huge shift, right? But it's immature to evaluate the meaning of the state, but in terms of the policy of a particular government, you have to have a long view. And say, you have a long view and say, right, is the state good for Judaism? Or is the state bad for Judaism? Okay. The counterpoint to the vote is the always enjoyable imagining a child like this. The sign language is just, you have to read for fun. It's always fun. You want to throw things at the wall, all sorts of things, but he's always fun, and he's one of the people who says the world is black and white, and it's such an interesting perspective that the world is black and white. Okay, so here's his essay. He was not part of the original symposium, but in 1969, he wrote that Isaac Gottlieb published, responded, I think he originally published in a journal called MTC or something like that, 1968 in Hebrew. And here we can see what his reaction was to the same question. The conquest of the whole Eretz Yisrael by the army of Israel some 2,000 years after the people of Israel lost sovereignty in its land is an event without historical precedent. Its impact is very great, even in all its practical implications about it yet been clarified. It has undoubtedly affected a change in the reality of Jewish existence, and this change is a fact. The question remains whether there has also been a turning point in orientation, in the spiritual foundation of the Jewish being and in the approach to Judaism. In short, a change in the realm of values. Because of the essential relations between the religion of Israel and the Jewish people throughout the generations, it seems to many religious Jews especially to the wounded members of the government and the patriotic youth, which is a nice thing, you know, the two immature groups, members of the government, and the patriotic youth, that the events of 1967 are interwoven with the progression of the Messianic redemption, with all the different meanings and implications that have been tied to this concept. The victory is taken as a religious achievement, and the military bravery which brought it as an expression of religious awakening. But choosing any sort of interpretation from all the meanings which the term spiritual implies, it is not possible to attribute to the Six-Day War, to the victories of the conflict, any spiritual significance. Nor can any results in the realm of the spiritual be expected to grow out of these events. Inasmuch as there was any awakening of the Jewish people in Israel and the diaspora, it was in the military warlike sense a common phenomenon in every nation, every society, every culture, and perhaps one of the interior ones. There is nothing specifically Jewish in this trait. We have seen wartime bravery revealed in England during the Blitz, and in Hitler's Germany, with people and army continued to fight at the cost of their lives until the very end, and all hope was gone forever. There is no need to be enthused by military heroism and ability to battle. These qualities are to be found even today among the good and the bad, among those who fight for lofty ideals and those who fight for evil and vanity. If there was no purpose in society and state in Israel before the 6 days, no sense of purpose was rendered by the war. It was a battle that was not for Torah, and which did not stem from the power of Torah from this direction, but simply a great national patriotic act of state, which is neutral in the purview of religion. And then I think it's just a brilliant paragraph, the next one. The generation that beheld the 10 plagues in Egypt and witnessed the splitting of the sea, they left faith and were destroyed in the desert. Those that saw revelation on Mount Sinai made the golden calf 40 days later. But the experience of thousands of years testified that tens of generations of Jewish men, women, and children were educated to love God and to revere Him to the point of martyrdom, Al Kiddush Hashem, even though God's presence never revealed itself to them, nor were miracles performed to them, nor was it their salvation from their enemies, and no prophets appeared in their midst, but they were educated in Torah and Mitzvot. In summation, there are no spiritual educational implications of the Six-Day War, the capture of Jerusalem and the whole Israel, but can't reveal the events of religious meaning. The pressing problems Israel and Judaism encountered prior to the 5th of June are still encountered today. That's about the story of that I give. I'll give ice cold water to import. Right, be imported by everybody else. That don't build religion on the belief that God, that you don't understand that God just intervened in history, because we look at the place where God did intervene in history, and that lasted 40 days. And that gets you nowhere. Okay, next.
We have the title of God being an
ancient, but
I don't know.
Yeah.
And then they have a lot of time.
Right.
And I'm not necessarily going to love them. Sure. They were nothing. So, I mean, you say, well, that's 48, but that may not be true. But many of the people, they, and I'm positive they were throughout history, and maybe they were responding to big, golden, huge...
No, he says exactly, there were people of faith all through the years because they saw miracles in everything because they believed in God. But the people who built their faith off the big miracles, right, you look at Tanakh and you say that even when God performed the biggest miracles in the world, that had no religious impact at all.
But he doesn't say, well, he created what he means, but he says there's normal miracles performed for
them. Okay, now what he means is, well, he means is open miracles. Okay. That's what he means, open miracles. Yeah, okay, he's not being a culture of Ashbel. Right, he's a very strong man, if I was this. He's a very, very strong man. Okay, now, here's the second Yeshayahu claim, which I think that's what he's dealing with the Six-Day War, and now he deals with Zionism as such. The state has no intrinsic value, only instrumental value. This principle is common to both the religious approach and the humanist approach, attributing to the state and intrinsic value of the essence of the fascist approach. The state itself is the enemy of the individual, since it is, by its very nature, an apparatus of power and coercion. Being an apparatus of this kind, it can neither realize nor embody values. Things of value are achieved only by men and not by the state. And to achieve them, men struggle among themselves within the framework of the state. There is not, nor can there be, unanimity among men concerning values, thus the state serves as an arena for the internal struggle. The only reason, the only justification for the existence of the state is the need it fulfills. Okay, all power and all authority of the state beyond the fulfillment of these vital needs is tyranny. Since all authority is converted immediately from the means to an end and is exploited by the rulers in every conceivable regime to strengthen their own rule. Okay, next paragraph. Even the network of Mitzvot and Adam L'Chaveiro, which includes the struggle between man and society, man and the nation, and man and the state, were not instituted from a humanist motivation. Human reality, both individual and collective, is viewed not per se, but from the viewpoint of the service of God. Okay, this leads to a basically critical approach to faith, even though its existence is recognized as essential. The conflict between religion and the sense of Judaism concerning the story of the state is of the essence of both religion and the state. Okay, so now let's articulate Leibniz's philosophy a little bit, and then explain how that relates to Zionism, and then we're going to reach the last two stages. Leibniz took the position, and I'm not an expert, I'm just putting other people in position as philosophy largely, that you can't do Talmud on the foot. The only purpose for any mitzvah is to do God's will. And he ended up in this ironic position. He argued, for example, that besides that, the existence of the state is a neutral category. And no religion values the state at all, because the state, the only issue in terms of the state is, does it accomplish me so, or does it not accomplish me so? You can't do having a state of value with that. Now it happens that Leibniz is a really interesting figure. He also thought that ethics, therefore, are non-religious. Because ethics is about helping human beings, but that's not what religion is about. Religion is about serving God. But he liked ethics, so he ended up becoming a major human rights campaigner, but he was very insistent to claim that he was not an ethics campaigner as a religious Jew. He also was a very ardent Zionist, but he was very strict to say he was a secular Zionist, because he thought it was a good thing. Right? He liked having a Jewish state, but that was irrelevant to his religion. Now what I want to take out from this, but what he says is really an extreme version of what the Rus says. Right? The state is not the end in and of itself. Right? The state is only useful insofar as it achieves a higher purpose. Now, the Rus tries to finesse this question by saying, but let's not look at what the state is doing now for Torah Mitzvot. Let's look at what having a state overall would make for Torah Mitzvot. That's a very mature, very complicated endeavor. How do you know the long run of the state does for Torah Mitzvot? You don't know. The Rav is fine to say you don't know what the end of the state does for your survival either. Because it's maybe just like Jews in one place. So here we have what I want to say is that, and notice if you reduce the state to just the means, if you don't give the state any intrinsic value, right? So one way to give the state intrinsic value is to say that it's called the dual. Right? But I have a hard time saying. So another way to give the state, right? But if you reduce the state to purely intrinsic value, then you end up raising the question, well, if the state stops fulfilling that value, what do you do? So for example, if you think that a specific purpose of the state is to enable you to fulfill the Mitzvah Kibosharis, and now the state is giving back the land, and you can rebel against the state and form an alternative state and maintain that land, right? So the state has no value at all. Right? If you think the purpose of the state is to punish Jews, and instead the state, you look at the state and say, look, they're doing the same thing the Russian government did, they made us close the legend. Right? It's not true historically, but in the midst of it. Right? Then you have a problem. So the question is there a way of claiming that the state has purely instrumental value because of what it actually accomplishes is to me also a risky foundation for religious Zionism, because it means your religious Zionism depends on your political evaluation. Right? Today I feel that in the long run the state will be good for Torah Mitzvot, yay, and in the long run, looking in the long run I think that, actually Jewish survival works better without political independence than leave the state.
Well, it's a little too late for that. The state's already there.
Yeah.
But not to say, oh, well, the state's not doing its job, but it's like, that's the only other
thing. So I think yesterday, when our attendee and I spoke together, it was minor orthodoxy. So I hear that, so I talked about something that I talked, which I claim generally, that there used to be a big debate between the minor orthodoxy and the Haredi world about religious Zionism. The Maharal Festival was religious Zionist, and the Haredi world was anti-Zionist, and we compromised. We all support Israel, none of us are religious Zionists. Because pragmatically, we say now, having a state of Israel, right, whether you think it was a good idea or not originally, but the idea is, right now, if you think this, lots of Jews would die. Right? That's not religious Zionism, right? There's no, right? That's just, that's like you throw me a star, right? So that's not enough to put, right? It's not. it's enough to generate support for Israel, even enough to religiously rally support for Israel, but it doesn't tell you anything about Halal. It doesn't tell you anything about, right, about religious education. It doesn't, right, it doesn't mean you make a pragmatic government. You know, on Hitler, you know, support the United States government, because the United States was, right, it will be really bad for the Jews. Right, that's not enough for religion. That's not enough for religion. Okay, you might say, you know, that's essentially the contemporary outlook, you know, which has brought, and we have failed to articulate a religion line of alternative. That's what I'm saying. Okay. One of the alternatives that I, for many years, found most attractive is set out by David Hartman. I give you a quote from the book called Living Covenant, because I do not have access to a collection called Joint Responsibility on the Turing Spectrum. But I should say, if you really care about religious Zionism, I think that probably one of the best things to read is David Hartman's Joint Responsibility. It's a wonderful collection. Should also read the Salvation 5 addresses, which, you know, which are tremendously inspirational. But for really clear working out of what the issues are, Joint Responsibility was one of the formative influences on me. But I only have to tell you, I'm giving the quote from Living Covenant, which I think is largely a reworking of that. Right, so for many Jews, Israel has become the last substitute for traditional Judaism. Israel is probably the last haven in the world, for Jewish secularism. Israeli normalcy enables many to assimilate and unite the nations of the world without feeling guilty for having abandoned their ancestors. With all the risks that Israel poses to the future of covenantal Judaism, right? It's pretty stark, right? He's not saying Israel is the cause of the greatest revival of Torah. Israel is what makes it possible for many people not to be from. I had Son of Repentah on reading the original, the first in Harry Kelman's, you know, Rabbi series, Monday the Rabbi. And the first thing that happens in that series is the rabbi, David the Rabbi Small, not the David Small look with, he's going to open that and choose a sermon. Billy Fred goes to Israel and stops seeing Shomer Shabbos. It's an amazing thing. And he goes back to America and becomes Shomer Shabbos again. I think he changes his opinion later, but he goes back to Israel in like the 8th book, and I think he's from there the second time, but in the original book, it's really quite striking. It's a fair book, though. It's actually very interesting, because it also has an Israeli Bahushuba in the same book. Right, with all of this, Israel poses to the future of covenantal Judaism, I am nonetheless prepared to build my hopes for Judaism's future on this new reality. For as the tradition teaches, where there is a potential for desecration, there is also a potential for sanctification. I live with a guarded hope that out of this complex and vibrant new Jewish reality will emerge new spiritual directions for the way Judaism will be lived in the modern world. Israel expands the possible range of halachic involvement in human affairs beyond the circumscribed borders of home and synagogue to the public domain. Jews in Israel are given the opportunity to bring economic, social, and political issues into the center of their religious consciousness. The moral quality of the army, social and economic disparities and deprivations, the exercise of power moderated by moral sensitivity, all these are realms that may engage halachic responsibility. From this perspective, the fact that Israel enables us to make the whole of life the carrier of the covenant is in itself sufficient to ascribe profound political significance to the secular revolt that led to Israel's rebirth. I celebrate Israel's Independence Day with a recitation of the Hall of Psalms, thus expressing gratitude to God for having given the opportunity to renew the full scope of the covenantal spirit of Judaism. My religious celebration is not a judgment on God's activity, but only on the opportunity that Israel made possible. The opportunity may be missed, but that does not in any way detract from the religious possibilities created by the event. The recitation of Psalms of Thanksgiving and Independence Day does not entail any divine guarantee regarding the successful realization of those opportunities. So you can hear my emphasis. Right? The critical point he says over and over again is opportunity made possible. Right? But here's the central piece. Have you got a question, Chris?
Isn't that the same thing if we fail this opportunity, then all we want to create is all the
shadows? Yes.
And how would we be thankful for the opportunity to create all the shadows?
You're thankful for the opportunity to have created a kiddush Hashem, and it's your fault if it didn't work. Right? So part of the thing I find really powerful is that Leibowitz is wrong when he says that a state is, that the only purpose of a state is as the instrument of coercion. The state sets the whole boundary, sets the whole framework of life. If you have a state, you can take responsibility. You don't just impose things on people, you create social contracts. And we determine, right, you know, if you have a truly, you know, language is taking, you know, a Hobbesian approach, right, that ideal, right, that the only purpose of the state is to protect people from each other, right, as you said, right? But there's a Lockean approach, right? The purpose of the state is, right, to enable people to do things collectively that they could not do individually. And there's tremendous religious value. We have in the Galut, not because of mystical reasons, but because of practical reasons, we have a deeply attenuated Judaism, because we let all the Christian Mishnah vanish, right? We don't have to deal with responsibility for minorities among them. It's all sorts of issues. It's just not real. Forget it's just a clear virus. Right? That's the trivial aspect of it. The question of what kind of healthcare system we ought to have. People will be forgiven for a little late lunch. So what he says is, the religion is not because it's messianic or not. It's messianic or not, as always. It depends on the messianic era, comes when he deserves it. And it's not whether it's God's intervention or not. I want to argue even more starkly with, you know, maybe you can claim that what we had is that God decided to give us a chance and not prevent us from having Eretz Yisrael, and that's enough. We were given the opportunity to create a state which is truly naturalistic, which is a key reality to the Mashiach. But in the same way, you know, we have to be grateful for everything that happens to us in life. You have to be grateful if you cross the desert. Does that mean that God miraculously intervenes while you cross the desert? No. God created a world in which you can cross the desert. And you made it. Yay. So that's offering the tremendous possibilities for non-messianic religious Zionism, which, as opposed to creating the temptation to do irresponsible things, or as opposed to creating the temptation to complacency, imposes the responsibility to do responsible things. To take responsibility for society and to be thankful all the time that guess what, now we have the opportunity to make halakha exactly what it's supposed to be and to take responsibility for our failures. Guess what, you know, some of you don't do it. Now, the only problem with it is, okay, this inspires me, I love this, I think that's the right way to do it, is that unfortunately we're just still in Israel. Because the state of Israel, and also has absolutely no influence on the state of Israel, and Judaism in the state of Israel.
I see me on the highway, I see this guy, you know, from Israel. And then we see Hebrew.
That's great.
So, I don't know if you can compare these children like in America, on the average Jew in America, the average Jew in America, children right thing will not be Jewish.
Okay, so I should say, I don't want to see, the failure is not so much the failure of the people in Israel, the failure of the halakhic community in Israel. The issues that Martin is talking about in terms of the economics, right, all that, you know, so in terms of, so you throw out, right, you know, there's stuff going on, but in terms of social justice, you know, you have Rosh Hashanah, and you know, a few of the Zohar people are married, and Rabbi Copper, and a few others, Danny Copper, and a few others trying to do it, but on the whole, the rest of the community in Israel, the Palestinian, the government is an opportunity, but it's an opportunity. it's really quite stark, you know, that we have, you know, we finally solved over this problem with the Treaty of Congress, and you know that the Interior Ministry now has higher standards for conversion than the government. And what was the last time an Orthodox thinker said something, the State Department, right, an American, was the only one who said things that mattered. Right? And just as they voted, the Supreme Court tried. But on the whole, David Rosen? There are things going on, but on the whole, if you ask me, you know, the Hartman Institute has, you know, tried, you know, all that, I don't think it succeeded in any way, but it was the only group that really tried to create a halakha that was relevant to all the Israeli society, and didn't succeed. I still think this is the right approach.
Wait a minute,
And then we got done.
I mean, you guys are not revenue for red training.
Yeah, people did. They still are trying, or still are trying. But you asked me to make a tremendous impact on them. If you're listening right now, I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced. You know, if that were the way we were judged, we wouldn't do so well. We should still be grateful for the opportunity, but at some point, maybe, you know, at some point we have to say the opportunity is kind of slipping away, because right now the impact is not so great. So I want to say one last thing, right, then we wrap up. I was made enough to quote myself at the end, but that's just how I remember to say it. The sitting out of possibility. Which is Baruch, in many of his writings, talks about dignity as a religious category. And what he means by dignity is self-determination. And the capacity to control your own life, that in and of itself is really a supreme religious good. In Natasha Day, God creates the world, right? And he is supposed to imitate God and create and determine this country's own existence. I can read this in a lot of different shares, right? There are all sorts of policies which are dependent on that model. So see the second way in which Playboy critique fails, is that he doesn't see self-determination as religious good. And hard to see self-determination as religious good only because of what you can achieve. And I would argue that no, actually in the Monroe's theology, self-determination in and of itself is religious good, which requires gratitude. And the second thing is that Hartman to some degree divorces you from Eretz Yisrael, it's trying to diminish that whole thing. But part of the capacity to turn your own standards is to have your own home, in your home, where you feel at home. So I want to suggest the last thing, that, you know, that we need to, that there's a value in developing your own Zionism, which actually does give intrinsic non-messianic meaning to statehood. Because simply having political autonomy, right, is being a dignified nation in the same way that having personal autonomy is being a dignified human being. And that is something that we need to express profound religious gratitude. We should use it the same way we should use our free will generally. We should use our free will to defend it and to be able to Hashem and all that. But if somebody, right, it's a value to give somebody freedom, even if they will misuse it. Right? And so we should have gratitude for God giving us national freedom, even if we misuse it. That's the hierarchy I want to set up, and I think first of all we should have gratitude for having autonomy. Secondly, we should have gratitude for having the opportunity to use that autonomy well and then try our best to live up to it. And then we can talk about the question of whether the state, aside from what we do with it, whether the state per se actually accomplishes, helps us accomplish certain things, so, which I think is the third level. And then, you know, if it turns out to be a few successful attainers, that would be terrific. Thank you very much.